You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it looks like we're in for bumpier flights and climate change is to blame.
First, passing a budget was a slow and heated process for Wisconsin, but the state finally did it last month, about 10 weeks after the deadline. And some Wisconsin lawmakers still aren't happy about how things went.
In an interview, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called senators who struck a last-minute deal with Governor Walker, quote, terrorists. Voss criticized the senators for refusing to let the budget pass unless the governor agreed to certain vetoes. Here's what he said to WISN's Mike Goucher.
Frankly, I wish Governor Walker hadn't negotiated with terrorists. I think that's a bad way to operate the legislature.
Terrorists, you call them
yeah.
Senators and terrorists.
That's what they are, because you don't hold somebody hostage for your own personal needs.
Voss's comments haven't gone over well since they aired yesterday, and he released an apology today.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's with us now to take a closer look. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, we've seen a lot of heated tension between parties, a lot of partisan conflict here. This is a little different because it's intra-partisan. This is all Republicans are talking about.
Yeah, and it's about a budget that passed a month ago. Mm-hmm. So it's unusual to see this kind of come up in the way that it did a month after that sort of emotions were raw. You know, obviously for Speaker Voss, you know, they're still a bit raw.
And walk us through what Speaker Voss is mad about now, this deal reached by three of his colleagues, Republican colleagues on the Senate side of the aisle with Governor Walker.
Yeah, so basically, I think it boils down to the process, a lot of it, and the fact that when these three rank-and-file Republican senators struck this deal with Governor Walker, in a way, it diminishes the power of legislative leadership. When you can have rank-and-file members go directly to the governor, get significant changes made to the budget, as they did, that diminishes the power of people like the Assembly Speaker. And so, going back a month, there was some question about when Republicans are ever going to come together on the budget. The legislature's budget committee, the Joint Finance Committee, hadn't met in quite a while. And typically, the way that they work these things is that that finance committee under Republicans, since they took control of state government in 2011, has operated as kind of like a conference committee. It irons out the differences between the houses, and that version of the budget then basically gets approved in the full legislature. It doesn't have to work that way. That's the way they've done it. What these three Republican senators did, whom the speaker referred to as terrorists, they negotiated a bunch of vetoes from Governor Scott Walker before they would vote yes on this budget in the Senate. That included vetoing a tolling implementation study, modifications to the Public Finance Authority, and a veto that sped up the implementation of the repeal of the state's prevailing wage law to immediate instead of waiting until September of next year.
And Speaker Voss, looking at this, said this, in effect, made the budget we passed different because of these vetoes that had been promised. So he said something like, we might not have voted for this budget if we'd known that this deal had been reached.
Yeah, he was really firm when there was talk that this might happen. The week that the budget went through the legislature, he said, you know, the assembly is done. We are not making any changes to this. This is the budget. And the Senate made changes. The Senate didn't make changes. If they had, they would have sent it back to the speaker. But because they went through the governor, they could kind of circumvent that. So what Voss is saying is, if I had known that, if my chamber had known that, maybe we wouldn't have agreed to this deal, because this was all part of a give and take between Speaker Voss, Senator Fitzgerald, and all of our members. And this deal that was struck by these three senators circumvented that.
Talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief about comments from Speaker Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, about some of his fellow Republicans referring to them this weekend as terrorists for a budget deal they made with Governor Walker. What was the reaction from those Republican senators and others in the party, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, Senator Scott Fitzgerald, who leads the Republicans in the Senate, issued a statement early on comparing three sitting state legislators to terrorists is beyond inappropriate. Negotiating vetoes is as much a part of the budget process as anything else. And the speaker's comments demonstrate a weak grasp of the events that transpired in the hours before the budget was passed. Senator Steve Nass, one of the legislators who was called a terrorist by the speaker, said it's beyond outrageous for anyone, especially a person serving as Speaker of the Wisconsin State Assembly, to label as a terrorist another person for simple public policy disagreements. Worse yet, when given the opportunity in the interview to retract or recalibrate, such a reprehensible statement. Speaker Voss firmly reiterated it, referring there to Mike Gachet kind of questioning, hey, terrorist, do you mean that? And he did.
Is it standard operating procedure for a senator who's preparing to vote yes or no on the budget to go and negotiate vetoes? I mean, maybe it happens behind the scenes. Doesn't seem like something that's happened this publicly in the past.
I think this the number of vetoes that they got negotiated from the senator that day, or excuse me, from the governor that day in order to become yes votes in the budget was significant. I mean, these were significant policy changes that they got in exchange for voting on the budget. Legislators asking the governor veto this or veto that or pursuing veto assurances is not new. That is part of the process because the governor is always going to get the final word on this stuff. But to kind of publicly come out there and say we're a no on this budget unless we get this, this, and this, and then to get it, that was a little bit different. I mean, you saw it was the same process, but to a larger degree this year.
So there's two arguments here, kind of the argument ongoing over the process and the argument over Speaker Voss using the word terrorists. He apologized for one of those two things in a statement today.
He did. So he said that, quote, as Speaker, I have strived to increase the civility within the legislature. I now regret using the word terrorist because it goes against the guidelines I've set for our chamber and myself. For that, I apologize. But he was not ready. Speaker Voss was not ready to back down from his criticism of these three Republican senators and their deal with the governor. It's really he's not calling the governor a terrorist by any means, but he is criticizing Governor Walker for striking this deal. And he says, quote, I continue to be concerned, however, that the actions of a few senators who cannot work with their colleagues in their own caucus could disrupt progress on important legislation for the people of Wisconsin. Will we now have to run everything past a few rogue holdouts before committees take executive action? So they are no longer being referred to as terrorists by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, but he is calling them rogue holdouts there and saying he's going to do everything in his power to prevent that in the future.
And there's a lot. The budget's the big deal, but there's a lot of legislation still out there, a lot of conservative priorities that I think most Republicans in the legislature would agree on in general. Is this dispute going to make it harder to pass some things?
Well, it probably doesn't help the relationship between the houses, which was a little bit raw after budget negotiations, to now kind of revive that. I mean, it probably doesn't help, right? One thing that Senator Nass kind of threw out there as a possibility for why this happened, he said that he called it a, quote, shallow political ploy to reignite the budget disagreement, to lay the groundwork to thwart conservative legislation from advancing in the fall floor session. That is one Republican senator's opinion on what might be happening here. There is a lot of legislation that's run through committees right now. Speaker Voss said in that same interview with Mike Gachet that he hoped to advance a mining bill, controversial mining bill. So it's not like he wants to do nothing, but he may not follow the same agenda as Steve Nass and also Senators Chris Kapinga and Dewey Strobel.
We've been talking about the response from senators, Republican senators here. How about Robin Voss's own caucus, Republicans in the Assembly? Have we heard anything from them saying you went a little too far here?
So I haven't seen that today. It may be out there. He ultimately answers to them, so he can
they're
be
the ones
out
who
there.
Elect him into
right.
the leadership role.
Exactly. So there's 64 Republicans in the Wisconsin State Assembly. They choose their speaker. And so he is able to go out there and make whatever statements he wants to, really, as long as they feel like it's in line with the caucus. We can speculate as to whether or not they thought that this was out of line. I'm not sure. I know that he has been out there making fairly combative statements against the governor for a long time now, and his caucus has backed him up on that.
There are Democrats in the legislature, too. They don't get to do much, being in the minority in both houses. Are they reacting to this? Are they watching and dancing dances of joy to see their Republican opponents arguing with each other?
I don't see them making a huge deal out of this just yet. I mean, when Wisconsin Now, the liberal group that is, often there to criticize Republicans, is saying, look, this is not terrorism. This is essentially log rolling. I mean, they asked the Dane County District Attorney to investigate this. That we haven't heard anything on whether he will. Another DA said that there's no grounds for that, but they've made some hay out of this. Democrats are going to call attention to Republican disagreements when it comes to process. It may be that other issues, the issues themselves, not the process, is what moves voters, though.
And any sign that the rift among Republicans after this budget process is going to, they're going to make nice anytime soon?
Well, as we talk here today, it would appear that they maybe have a ways to go yet. You know, we'll see what the fall session looks like and what the tone is, and whether this continues.
We'll leave it there for now. Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to talk about some controversy surrounding still the budget and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss.
First, we hate to be the bearers of bad news, but if you fly for work or for pleasure, it's likely going to get less pleasant in the coming years.
And we're not talking about smaller seats, longer lines, or higher prices, although those might happen too. It turns out that climate change and the most heavily traveled air routes will combine to create a lot more turbulence over the next few decades.
Sarah Sloat is a writer based in Brooklyn, and she took a look at the science behind this for Inverse.com. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we talk about turbulence a lot, but give us a brief overview about what causes turbulence.
Yeah, so there's different types of turbulence. There's turbulence from events like storms and cold weather, which pilots can usually anticipate because they can either see the weather coming towards them or weather events show up on a radar suite. But then there is also clean air turbulence, also known as CAT. And that's high altitude bumpiness caused by strong vertical wind shear in regions without cloudiness. And because there's no clouds, you can't be detected visually or by a conventional weather radar. So basically, there's a disruption to the smooth horizontal flow of the air, which happens in the currents of an unstable atmosphere. And that's the sort of clean air turbulence is the sort of turbulence that would emerge from climate change.
And so how is climate change exacerbating this?
Yeah, so essentially increased carbon dioxide causes spikes in air turbulence because they change the temperature of the air, which in turn changes air currents. So this is an example of how impacts of climate change can be felt through the circulation of our atmosphere, not just through increases in surface temperature.
And so the research that you looked at is considered current generation. It's a current generation climate model. For those who are unfamiliar, what is that exactly?
Yeah, so this climate model was created by scientists at the University of Reading who study meteorology, and it was just published in a journal called the Geophysical Research Letters. And essentially, this is a supercomputer simulation that's the first ever really global projection of in-flight bumpiness at this large scale. And ultimately, what they found through this model, which they plugged in weather information from different geographic regions and turbulent strength categories and different seasons, they ultimately revealed that clean air turbulence will triple from its current frequency sometime between 2050 and 2080.
So what will that, so far, crystal ball methods, models, stuff like that, what could that look like for, people who are traveling or, airline industries as they, it's only 2017, but 2050 is really not that far away. What will this, be like for the industry?
Yeah, clean air turbulence doesn't pose a major danger to flights, but it definitely is responsible for hundreds of passenger injuries every year. It can create a tricky situation for flight attendants who are standing up. Basically, it's just a lot more uncomfortable, and it's a very common cause of serious injuries to flight attendants. And in the press release from the University of Reading, they also note that turbulence is thought to cost the United States air carriers up to $200 billion annually. So it's definitely something to be thinking about in terms of being ready for, because we currently don't have technology that can sort out whether there is going to be clean air turbulence on the horizon.
I'd like to get back to that technology in just a moment, but I want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Sarah Sloat. She is a writer based in Brooklyn, and she has been writing about how climate change could potentially severely impact air travel in the future, namely through turbulence. And, you know, we've been talking about this clean air turbulence. Pilots can't see it. And you talked about a little bit about, you know, potential technology. Do you know where we are right now with those sort of advancements or where they could go?
This study is kind of a call to arms, essentially, for that sort of technology. It highlights the need to improve turbulence forecasts, which then can turn reduce the risk of injuries to passengers and lower the cost of turbulence to airlines. At the moment, basically, pilots hear about turbulence from reports from air traffic control. In terms of what else could be done to mitigate the effects, it comes down to, you know, lessening the amount of CO2 that goes into our atmosphere. Right now, there's various stages of carbon negative technologies that could reduce that, but there's no mainstreaming of them. It's also being conscious about the impact of your carbon footprint. I mean, for example, if you take a round trip flight between New York and California, that's about 20% of the greenhouse gas that your car emits for the entire year. And it's estimated that the aviation industry accounts for about 11% of transportation-related emissions in the U.S. So we as humans have a power to reduce our carbon footprint, which in terms will help us in a lot of ways, one of which is reducing turbulence.
Sure. And, you know, the airline industry, I mean, it's a huge industry. The likelihood it's going anywhere soon is that's unlikely to happen. It's just pragmatically not going to happen. And you just mentioned the routes between California and New York. Is this something specific to high travel areas, or is this going to have a pretty big worldwide impact?
Yeah, so it's going to have a worldwide impact. In the model, they found that the largest increases were in the international airspace and the busiest parts of transportation across the globe. Basically, that's because more planes means more warming of the atmosphere. The model found that, for example, between 2050 and 2080, that clean air turbulence should increase by 180, become 180% more common across the North Atlantic, 110% more common across North America, and 160% more common over Europe.
And, you know, airline travel already is maybe not the most comfortable way to travel. I don't know about you. I'm 5'11". It's already really, really difficult to get on a plane. You know, can you break it down for just average listeners, you know, what 2050 could feel like in the air for them?
Yeah, I mean, the strengthening of wind instabilities at high altitudes because of clean air turbulence means that pockets are of rough air, which is the turbulence, is stronger and more frequently. So, you know, like if you're on a flight, ideally turbulence is something that happens only once out of every 10 flights or at a lower frequency. And this is basically saying that, you know, we're going to experience a lot more of it. An earlier study from the University of Reading that only looked at the airspace above North America found that by the middle of this century, if there's no efforts to reduce atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, the volume of light turbulence, which is less impactful than the CAT that we were talking about earlier, is still going to increase by 59%. So it means that you are still safe on your flight, but you certainly are going to be uncomfortable with all the bumpiness.
So are there, I mean, there are ways to mitigate this, it sounds like, but do you see any push so far to make sure that, you know, this issue is mitigated?
I mean, I think overall the study, you know, the study is part of a longstanding research about how the relationship between climate change and carbon dioxide, but it's still very much in the theoretical model point. And ideally, the more people hear about the science, the more there will be a rallying call for the sort of technology that could help. But I think that when it comes to an individual level, it really comes back down to each doing your own part to like help reduce carbon negative atmospheres.
And do you have any future advice for air travelers, either in terms of being prepared for these flights or finding alternative, you know, ways to travel?
Yeah, I mean, I think going to the point of what you could do to help, how if you're a frequent flyer who wants to not experience so much turbulence, I mean, flying nonstop is more beneficial than having layovers. According to this 2010 report, about 25% of airplane emissions come from landing and taking off. And so flights that are just one way are a lot more beneficial to the eventual amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. But besides that, I wish I had better advice. I don't like turbulence either.
Sure. I mean, you're not a psychic. There's no way to really know. But this is a really good way to at least prepare and to keep in mind as, you know, you're going on to whatever website you get your tickets on and, you know, maybe plan a trip, maybe just a state away. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
Sarah Sloat is a writer based in Brooklyn. She writes for Inverse.com and joined us today to talk about why air travel might get significantly less comfortable in the coming years.
Now, if you have a difficult time keeping New Year's resolutions, taking direction from a boss at work, making time for yourself, or you just ask too many questions, you might fall into one of four very different personality tendencies.
And our next guest says understanding what makes each of these tendencies unique can help make people be happier and lead more productive lives.
Gretchen Rubin joins us now. She writes about happiness and human nature. Her podcast is called Happier. Her latest book is The Four Tendencies, the indispensable personality profiles that reveal how to make your life better and other people's lives better too. Gretchen, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm so happy to be talking to you.
So we've got these personality types, Gretchen, and I got to say, I'm usually skeptical when people have these personality types that are going to tell us all about who we are and so on. But yours is really specific. You're just measuring really our personalities as far as getting stuff done and making changes in our lives. Can you talk about that?
Right. You're exactly right. This is very narrow. What these four tendencies tell you is how a person responds to expectations. And we all face two kinds of expectations, outer expectations, you know, the expectations that come from the outside, like a work deadline or a request from a friend, and then our own inner expectations, what we expect from ourselves. We want to keep a New Year's resolution. We want to get back into practicing guitar. And so whether you're an upholder, a questioner, obliger, or rebel, all that that tells you is how do you respond to expectations.
Did you have kind of a eureka moment for this way of thinking about this?
You know, I had noticed so many patterns. Like, one of the most striking was a friend who said, "I don't understand it. When I was in high school, I was on the track team, and I never missed track practice, so why can't I go running now?" And I was like, well, why? I had been noticing all these patterns, and then finally one day, I was looking down at my to-do list, you know, just sitting in front of my computer, and the word just flashed into my mind, expectations. And I realized that that was really at the heart of a bunch of patterns that I had noticed, but I couldn't really figure out how they fit together.
So what matters is who has the expectations and how we react to them. Now, let me see if I've read your book right. That person who did great on staying on schedule in track but couldn't get motivated on their own, are they an obliger?
Yes. Bing,
right.
Bing, bing.
Boom.
Yes.
So let's talk about the obliger type. What is that?
And this is the biggest tendency. This is the one that the largest number of people fit into for both men and women. And obligers are people who readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So exactly as you said, my friend, when she had a team and a coach waiting for her, she had no trouble showing up. But when she was just trying to go running on her own, she struggled. That is the obliger tendency.
And I want to go through the other tendencies now. The upholder. They're the one you can count on to get stuff done no matter what, it sounds like.
Yeah, upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. So they want to meet other people's expectations, but their expectations for themselves are just as important.
And then there's the questioner.
Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So they make everything an inner expectation. If it meets their standard, they'll do it. If it fails their standard, they will resist. They typically don't like anything arbitrary, inefficient, unjustified. They always want to know, why should I?
And then finally, there's the rebel.
So the rebels are people who resist outer and inner expectations alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. If you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. Typically, they don't even want to tell themselves what to do. Like, they don't sign up for a class every Saturday because they don't know what they're going to want to do on Saturday.
And you say it's not like one of these is the good one and the other ones are the bad one. They all have their ups and downs.
Exactly. Each has strengths and weaknesses. Each tendency has people in it who are highly successful and also big losers. It's not a matter of that one is better than the other. When you look at the people who are the happiest, the healthiest, the most productive, and the most creative, they're the people who have figured out how to harness the strength of their tendency, but then also how to offset the weaknesses and limitations of their tendency so they can get the life they want.
We'll get into that in a bit because that's really the crux of your book. How do we manage ourselves, our personality type? But let's start with how do we figure out which one of these we are?
Well, there's a quiz you can take online, happiercast.com/quiz. It's a very simple, free, easy quiz. More than a million people now have taken this quiz. But a lot of times people can tell just from that brief description. Like, they get it, you know? You sort of realize, like, oh, well, when I think back on my life, like, yeah, whenever any something made sense to me, I could do it. But when, you know, somebody gave me a dumb assignment that I thought was a big waste of my time, I had no trouble saying no, even though the teacher yelled at me. Or upholders are often told that they're too rigid. Questioners are often told they ask too many questions. Obligers often say things like, why is it that I can meet everybody else's priorities, but I can't meet my priorities for myself? And with rebels, people are often complaining, like, why don't you ever do anything I ask you to do? So those are some tells.
We're talking about expectations and motivation with Gretchen Rubin. Her new book is called The Four Tendencies. And this can be really important. I think about, and I think you give the example, but a doctor's office. A doctor says, hey, quit smoking.
Yes.
And the upholder is going to say, okay.
Yeah.
The questioner says, prove to me why. The rebel says, don't tell me what to do. The same statement is going to work differently for different people, so we kind of have to try to tailor it, whether we're talking about a health message or a work message or whatever. It's really important who the audience is for that message.
Absolutely, 100%. When you see that someone's not getting with the program, like whether it's you, yourself, or you're dealing with someone else, how you would communicate with them to try to convince them or to bring them along would be radically different depending on who they are. Because, right, for a rebel saying, well, you have to do this, this is doctor's orders, we all desperately want you to quit smoking, that's not going to work for them. For a rebel, you'd say something more like, you don't want to be addicted to nicotine. You want to be free from cravings. You don't want to be controlled by big tobacco companies with their fancy packages. You don't want people to tell you where you can stand and, oh, you can't go to this restaurant and you can't stand in this doorway. You want to be free. You want to make choices. Absolutely. When you know the tendencies, you can communicate much more effectively because you can hone in on the message that's going to resonate most deeply with that tendency.
And not only might something not work, I mean, I've seen studies of public health campaigns in the past that say, yeah, for some people, these things backfire. I mean, if the message is really targeted perfectly to a few of these groups, it might actually drive the other group to the wrong behavior.
No, absolutely. One thing that rebels often say is they hate that sign, you know, and you see them everywhere. Thank you for not smoking. Thank you for not speeding. Somebody said, if I see a sign that says thank you for not speeding, it makes me want to speed up because I don't want you to think, like, I'm not doing it because you told me to. Right. So, exactly. There could be counterproductive. Or, like, accountability. Outer accountability is crucial for obligers. And so something like, oh, you know, and a nurse is going to call you once a week and check up on you, that could be super helpful for an obliger. But for a rebel, it might make them resist altogether. And a questioner might say, like, they might welcome it. They might say, oh, this is going to make it easier. Or they could be like, why are you wasting my time with all these phone calls? This doesn't make any sense to me. So you would want to say, you would want to explain, like, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this once a week? Why are we checking up on you? Why are we telling you to take it with food? Why are we telling you to do it in the morning? Why? They need those robust justifications.
Now, I took the quiz, and I got to say, even though my workplace joke catchphrase is, the producers know this, don't tell me what to do, I came out evenly split among everything but rebel. And that makes me think, like, what about people who are bridging multiple groups here?
Well, you know, all of us share a little bit of it. Nobody wants to be totally controlled by others, so we're all a little bit rebel. Nobody wants to do something that's a stupid waste of time, so we're all a little bit questioner. Mm-hmm. All of us will sacrifice something that's important to us in order to do something for someone else if it's important enough, so we're all a little bit obliger. But I do think people have a core tendency, which is sort of their instinctual reaction to an expectation. But that said, All of the tendencies overlap with other tendencies. So if you're a questioner, well, questioners are like upholders and that they both readily meet inner expectations. And questioners are like rebels and that they both resist outer expectations. So if you're a questioner, you could be more on the upholder side or more on the rebel side. So like my husband is an upholder who tips, is a questioner who tips to upholder, which, and I'm an upholder, so that's good for me because he's kind of closer to me. And I think that means that we see the world more similarly because we share that.
Let's talk about the friend of yours that started this off, the person who could exercise on the track team, couldn't make the time to do it on their own dime, on their own time. What kind of advice do you have for that kind of obliger to get that internal motivation when they usually just function better with external motivation?
So that is absolutely a crucial question. And I think when rebels focus on trying to have inner motivation, making themselves a priority, making time for themselves, that does not work. It is not effective. What is effective is outer accountability. And outer accountability, there's a million ways to build an outer accountability. So what would I say to that woman now? I'd say sign up for a class where they take attendance. Work out with a trainer one-on-one. Work out with a friend who's going to be annoyed if you don't show up. Take your dog for a run, and your dog's going to be really disappointed if he doesn't get the run that he loves so much, and he's going to tear up the furniture. You know, go do a 5K for a charity that you really value, and they're not going to make as much money if you don't do that run. Think of your duty to be a role model for somebody else. There's a million ways to create outer accountability once you realize that that is what you need. If you want to read more, join a book group. Like, it's always for obligers about creating outer accountability, even for inner expectations. That is what works. It's quick and easy. It's a very straightforward fix, and that is what works.
We're talking to author Gretchen Rubin right now about the four personality types she outlines in her latest book. It's called The Four Tendencies. She says we can learn a lot about how to get ourselves motivated and how to motivate others, too.
And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. Do any of these personality types sound like you? What motivates you to get something done or make a change in your life? And what doesn't? We all have those moments. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're continuing our conversation with Gretchen Rubin. She's with us to talk about her latest book, The Four Tendencies, the Indispensable Personality Profiles that Reveal How to Make Your Life Better and Other People's Lives Better, too. And she's breaking down the four personality types in her book, those being the upholder, the questioner, the rebel, and the obliger.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Based on what you've heard, what personality type do you think you are? What motivates you to do something? What doesn't work? What motivates you to do the exact opposite? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or check out the Ideas Network Facebook page. There's a link to a quiz. You can learn a little more about yourself there. We'll go next to Charlene with us in La Crosse. Charlene, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask, Charlene?
I wanted to ask actually about the personality type or the type of rebel. After listening to the descriptions, it sounds like that's what my husband is. And I just wanted to see how could I approach him differently when I'm asking for things with his help around the house. You know, she talked about like the doctor giving orders to quit smoking. I found that just asking him outright to, or telling him, you know, I need you to do these kind of things, doesn't really work, and kind of makes him a little bit more stubborn on doing it. So wondering if she has any suggestions.
And Charlene, I think you're probably the only person in the world dealing with this situation. No,
right.
I'm kidding. Gretchen, this is all over the place, isn't it? What do you suggest, Gretchen, for Charlene?
Well, one thing that's interesting is when there's a rebel who's paired up, either in a relationship or at work, it's almost always with an obliger. So that's a very dominant tendency. So if you're paired up with a rebel, it's very likely that you're an obliger. So how do you get a rebel to do what you want? Well, It is hard, because if you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. So one thing is to remember, they can do anything they want to do. They can do anything they choose to do, and they often like to express their identity. And so if you remind them of their identity, of wanting to be a considerate member of the household, of wanting to do what's fair and what's their share, that will often, when you do this, it makes me feel like I can count on you. When you do this, like, it makes us feel like we're a team. They may choose to do it out of love for you, and so to remind them of their identity. Also, information consequences choice. Give the rebel the information they need. Tell them the consequences of their action, and then let them choose. So you could say something like, well, you know, we need to clean out the guest room because your parents are going to come stay with us in 2 weeks, and next week we're going to be out of town. So we have to do it this weekend, or we're not going to have time to do it. And if we don't, then your parents are going to be staying in a room that's full of stuff. That's information consequences choice. But what you have to be willing to do is to let negative consequences fall. You can't stay up until 3 a.m. then cleaning out the guest room, because then there's no problem. There's no negative consequences. You have to let negative consequences fall, and that can be difficult. And another thing is not to remind, not to nudge. The more you remind somebody or ask somebody to do that, the more you ignite the spirit of resistance. So let them do it in their own way, in their own time. Let them be spontaneous. Never say to a rebel something like, well, wouldn't it make more sense to do this in the morning? No, no, no. If they feel like working on the porch right now and it's midnight, that's great. You feel like doing it now? I'm not going to get in your way. Do it when you want to do it in your own way. Somebody who's married to a rebel said, it took me 20 years to realize that the less I ask for, the more I get. It is very hard. Wrap your mind around this, but saying like, you need to do this, or you said that you would do this, or I need you to do this, it's like that ignites that spirit of resistance.
Yeah, it sounds like that being ready to put up with that negative consequence a couple times, because maybe, I don't know, the timber collection is still sitting in the guest room when mom and dad show up, and
you have to let that happen. Over and over, rebels have said, if you insulate, if you protect, if you rush to the rescue to protect a rebel from negative consequences, then there's no reason to do anything different. Then that works great, because it's like, I did what I wanted, and there was no, like, everything worked out fine, right? Everything was fine. Like, what's the big deal? It's like, yeah, because I, you know, so you have to be willing to put up with those negative consequences. And unfortunately, if you're married to somebody, a lot of times those negative consequences might blow back on you too. If you don't pay the cable bill, well, I'm the one who gets her cable cut off. But you have to be willing to sort of let that happen, or pay the cable bill yourself. Or what many rebels do is pay, if they have either automate things like automate bill paying, or pay for somebody to do chores that they don't want to do. You don't want to do it? Fine. Then we're going to have to pay somebody to do it.
All right. Good luck, Charlene. We're all pulling for you.
Yeah.
We're talking to Gretchen Rubin.
That's
author,
a common question.
Author of the book, The Four Tendencies, looking at the different ways people are motivated by themselves or others or nothing at all. Jeff is with us next at 800-642-1234. Jeff calling from Onalaska. Jeff, hi.
Hey, just wondering, as opposed to some of the other personality tests, like the color tests and things, where would this maybe be a practical application to use as opposed to some of the other tests that are out there? And then kind of a follow-up, when you are using some of these techniques with the other personality types, what happens if you kind of get busted that you're trying to sell them and they figure out which one and the issues that can address?
Jeff, thanks. Thanks for calling. A couple good questions there. First, as you mentioned earlier, Gretchen, this is more particular kind of than your Myers-Briggs and the color tests and things like that. But where does your where do your tendencies fit on that landscape?
You know, I'm a big fan of personality frameworks. I love having a vocabulary and a different way of thinking about patterns in behavior. And I think each of them has their own nuance and their own power. And I think you lose that nuance if you try to say, like, this corresponds to that or this equals that. So I think, like, let them all stand on their own and kind of put them together in however is the most illuminating for you. But I don't think it really works to try to create equivalencies.
And then do you want people to know that you're trying to use their tendencies for or against them?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it's helpful. I think the more that you can have a shorthand to say, like, hey, I know this is probably really bugging you because you're a questioner, or, you know, do we need to set this up, you know, better for you as an advisor? I mean, to me, I think that would be helpful. But I have to say, I can imagine situations where people might might not like that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. Appreciate it. I mean, this, a lot of this rings true to me. I'm a little like your friend on the track team, though I wasn't on the track team either. But when it comes to trying to get motivated for exercise, like the fitness tracker with my family members is helping motivate me, getting a free treadmill in the basement. So it was so pathetic if I couldn't even do that little amount of exercise. That shame got me to overcome my lack of internal motivation. This, when people do this, they can actually make productive changes, it sounds like.
No, they really can. And I think for a lot of people, there's a lot of relief because they think like, well, you know what? It's not that there's something wrong with me. It's not that I lack willpower, I don't have self-control, or I don't have to feel bad because something's easier, comes easily to my brother-in-law or my sweetheart, and it's hard for me. It's like, whatever tendency you are, there's a lot of people in the same boat as you. There are a lot of strategies for dealing with it. Like, you don't need to change. There's nothing wrong with you. It's just a question of how do we set things up so that you get where you want to go. And I think for a lot of people, especially people who have tried and failed numerous times, seeing like, oh, okay, this is the thing that's going to unlock whatever behavior it is that I want to follow, there's a real relief to that.
I wanted to ask about, we haven't spent a lot of time on the questioners, and let's talk about like a manager dealing with a questioner. This person drives me nuts. Every time I say I want to do something, they're asking why and for details and motivation and justification. What do you tell a manager in that situation?
Well, you're exactly right. There's a lot of strengths of being around questioners because they're the ones that are keeping people focused on efficiency and justification and why are we doing this at all? And those are really important questions to ask, especially in the workplace. But they often will drain and overwhelm other people with their questions. They can seem obstructionist. They can seem stubborn. They can seem like bottlenecks. If you have a manager, you can start feeling like someone's undermining your authority or questioning your judgment or, it's just not, like not a team player. That's something that questioners often get. And so I think one of the things that's good about the four tendencies is it allows you to realize there's nothing personal here. This person is not undermining my authority. They're not attacking me. They're not trying to slow down this process. They really just need to have their questions answered. And in fact, if I'm giving a presentation to a whole group of people, maybe I'll say, hey, if you've heard enough about why we're switching to this different software program, feel free to go back to your desk. If you want to stay here and talk about it some more, I'm here to answer your questions so that other people are free and don't have to like roll their eyes as the questioners keep asking the questions. But all these things, there are strengths and weaknesses, and there's many strengths to having a questioner. And sometimes when you're like, well, the upside comes with a downside. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes it kind of drives me crazy. I don't have to take it personally. This person is this way all over the place. It has nothing to do with me. Then you can manage it in a calmer way. It doesn't feel so emotionally loaded or as personal.
It's a good place to leave it. Gretchen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Gretchen Rubin. She's a podcaster and author. She's best known for The Happiness Project. We've been talking about her most recent book. It's called The Four Tendencies, the Indispensable Personality Profiles that Reveal How to Make Your Life Better and Other People's Lives Better, too.
And you can go to WPR.org to read an excerpt of the book and find a link to the quiz, which will help you determine your personality type if you're curious.